It's the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Complicated world out there requires some sophisticated techniques, and I'm going to force feed them into your brain. At least I'm going to offer them. You can nibble whatever you want. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, trying to get some perspectives from the ancient world of rhetoric and the modern world of rhetoric out into the world. The Rhetoric Warriors podcast, I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. That's fun. I convert conservatives because they worry me. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. This podcast has more rhetoricians than any podcast you're going to hear today. I stand by that claim. Today's another episode of Persuasion Pros, which I'm really looking forward to. Today's guest has identified herself as a multi-potentialate, which is a word I think we both just learned. And it means good or even great at a lot of things. So we'll talk into that. Rhetoricians love new words. She's the host of her own podcast, Choice Happens, founder of Marvy Moms, frequent guest on Good Morning Rochester, which sounds like a sitcom. Good Morning Rochester.
Good day, Rochester. We want the whole day to be good, not just good the morning.
Day. All right.
Yeah.
Good day, Rochester. That's even better. It's even more sitcom-y.
Yeah.
Loser of, I think, 100 plus pounds, which you can see at Savvy Nom Nom. Multi-potentialate has a lot of potentialates out there. And she fixes all things website-y at WhizBang. Emily Carpenter.
Hello.
Hello. That's a lot.
That's
you have a lot of slides in your water park. You have a lot of...
I do. Yeah, and I get to choose which one to go down every day. So that's really nice. Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about you, other than the fact that you do 90 things. I can see your background a little bit.
Oh, what do you have a particular question on my background?
I don't know. Like, you have a white
broad question. Background.
Just tell us how you got where you are. Like, you do websites.
Yeah.
You do all these sort of guru-esque businesses.
Right.
Which one kind of like grabs your mind right now? How'd you end up in this space of, because I'm the same thing. Like I must have 50, 75 projects that I could work on.
Wow. Right. Yeah. That's a lot. You might beat me there. I think that so to go back a little bit here, my degree is in sociology. So I have a degree in sociology, and I also had a minor and psychology and a concentration in social work. So my interest is in people. So everything that I do goes back to that, to my interest in people and how they think and how they act and what makes them tick. So I did that, I went through my 4-year degree in that, and my internship was actually in working for Child Protective Services in a rural county.
Man, that sounds like a tough job.
It was. And I got to go see lots of different living situations and see how people live. And the thing is that, people can not be so nice to their kids, no matter what their financial, their economic status is. It goes across all different types of people. So you can't make an assumption walking in whether something is good or bad. Everything is, people are people.
It's on the table. Humans can do what humans do.
Exactly. Yeah. So I got to see a lot of that, and I went into a lot of different people's homes and saw how they were living. And I saw the effect of that work on the social workers that worked in that job for the county. And I realized I didn't want to become that. So I enjoyed helping people and working with people, but I saw the burnout is real. And the people that were burnout didn't even know that they were burnout. They were just going into work every day and bitter and angry and just disillusioned from what they were seeing every day. And I only had to see that for about 3 or 4 months. And then I was done with that. And they were going, and some of them had been there 20 years or more. And so they had just seen it all. and realize what are they going to actually do to help. It didn't matter how many people they helped. There was always another person to help.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so I realized I wanted to be able to still help people, but not to the point where I forgot why them. I was there. What's that?
That you had to get involved with them. Like,
I tell
people this about like persuasion. So ostensibly this podcast is about teaching people about persuasion. Yeah. And everybody wants to do like it's called the magic bullet or the lightning strike, say the right thing and they just convert. I'm like, no. Persuasion is the ultimate grind. You are grinding your way through beliefs that people have had in their heads sometimes for decades.
Have these emotional
connections. If you want to change somebody, great. Well, just get ready to have some battery because it's going to take some work.
It does. Right. And so you go into a home and you see what's going on and that it's going to take a lot to change that or to make it a healthy environment. And most of the time it could be just temporary and they go back to how they were living. So when I saw the effect on the social workers that worked in those jobs, I decided I didn't want that because I didn't know if I was any different than anyone else. I thought if I do something like a job like this and I stay in it, I figured they all came in with the same intentions that I did, that they wanted to help people and that they had a big heart and they wanted to just walk in and make a difference.
Sounds great though, doesn't it? Just to walk in and make a difference.
Right. It sounds really great. But the reality was that after so many years of doing that, they weren't that person anymore. They had become something different and not in a good way. So I decided that I didn't want to do that. And so I didn't want to be a social worker, but I did go right after college and I worked in human services because it's what I knew. And so I was working with adults with developmental disabilities. And then I moved into working with adults with mental illness and chemical dependency, and sometimes both, and worked in that field for a while as a financial case manager. And then I just took steps toward more technology. I knew I didn't want to do the human services anymore. I love the people that I worked with. I did not like the politics behind it, the paperwork and the people that were just promoting with it, like promoting themselves, but there was nowhere for me to go because I wasn't one of the people at the top already. So it was very difficult field to stay in. And I think maybe that's okay. Maybe it just needs to have young people in there to be in there and then have them move on and do something else. And I'm glad that it's tough, like the same thing,
the impetus of doing something good in the world that you think you'll be good at and you have something to offer. It's the same thing gets behind a lot of teaching. Like when I went into work as a professor, it was because I'd come from a working class community and I was the first person in my family to go to college. And I'm like, I've learned some things that these people can use. And so you go in there with this idea of, hey, I've got some valuable stuff for you guys. And then you see like they're basically just trying to keep their heads above water. They're not really ready to absorb new things and to do all that kind of stuff. And then, like you said, the politics comes rushing in. Like anytime you're dealing with helping human beings, it becomes a political nexus for all these people who think what you should be helping them towards and what you shouldn't.
Right.
And then the administration of it and all that kind of stuff. It is like college professor to me was a horrible job.
I've heard that from a few college professors.
It's hard because it's a mix of jobs. Like one of the jobs is teaching, which is awesome. I love information and sharing that. But then you also have to grade, which is antithesis to teaching because it's now, you're the guardian holding them back from things. And then you have to administrate and then you have to it's crazy.
It's a lot. Yeah. That's why I like being an entrepreneur because I can pick the parts that I like to do and then shape things the way I want them to be without having to deal with all of that extra.
Yeah. I think a lot of people these days, even my kids who are coming up, you can just feel it. They're like, they get into an institution or a corporation, like, I want to get out of here.
Yeah. I think at this point I consider myself unemployable. I don't think I could work full time for anybody because the minute you put me into that and I have to, do benchmarking, that's when I was ready to leave my last job was when I had to do benchmarking and we had to record every minute of what we were doing and what project we were working on. And I was doing a lot of things that weren't really billable hours. They were projects and committees and pilot programs and the different things that I was doing that weren't really my main job, which was as an editor. And so I would get my time card at the end of the week and I did what I was supposed to do and do the benchmarking. And I was honest about what I was doing. And my boss looked at it and she said, Emily, we need to talk. You can't put all this stuff down that you're doing all this. It needs to be billable to a publication. You can't put it down like this. But that's what I'm doing. You know, this is, you're telling me to do this job and don't say that I'm doing this job. So it, then the benchmarking doesn't mean anything.
Right.
It's useless. So why benchmark? So I didn't want to have to account for every minute of my day to anybody. And I haven't since then. So.
The facade of you know, efficiency and profit and loss and all the things that protect you in a corporate and a capitalist environment. And you look at it and you're like, I remember in academics, somebody in sociology was arguing about a paper that she had written that it needed to be rigorous. And then and I'm like, why? I said, rigorous is just a rhetoric. It just means you've thrown a bunch of more stuff on there to make it dense.
Right.
It doesn't make it more true.
Yeah. It doesn't make it more meaningful or useful either. It's just that you can now point to a defense
mechanism. Like you have a defense shield that says, well, look at all the things that I, you know, all the citations and all the, like, well, that's great. It's still not very interesting or true.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, I get you. Okay. So that spun you out into entrepreneurial universe.
It did. Yeah. So
I'll build 9 planets out here so I can have my own little solar system.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I do. Yeah. I kind of feel like I'm in my own universe sometimes, and that's okay. I've always been that way from when I was a kid. I haven't ever done things exactly the way everyone else does them. I do them maybe a little slower, a little different, a little bit offbeat, and I'm okay with that. It sometimes upsets other people that I do that.
Like what? Give me a kid's story where you were just oddly different.
Okay, so I got the perfect one for you, Dan. So I was in second grade, and my second grade teacher, I don't know what the assignment was, but I was at my desk and I was doing it too slowly. She didn't like that I was doing things so slowly. So she came over to my desk, and all I remember is she started shaking me. She grabbed me by the shoulders and she started shaking me. And she said, "You are as slow as molasses in January," like that, like really loudly and clearly, and shook me.
And traumatizingly. Yes, she traumatized.
Traumatizingly, yeah. You know, I don't know. I have the memory, the experience. I don't remember being like overly upset about it. She was not nice to anybody. She was not
my
a nice.
My favorite thing right now is that balloon floating behind you. It just floated into frame while you were telling the story.
Yeah, it's a smiley face balloon. Maybe he'll visit. He's getting.
Yeah,
a little
I like it. I'm going to start having balloons behind me that can visit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can leave it there. It's okay.
Yeah, let it go. What's your son's name?
It's John Warner.
John Warner. Well, let it go, John Warner.
Yeah, my stage hand over here. He's
nice.
Making sure we have everything we need. So she shook me, and I went home and I told my parents what had happened. And my dad was so upset by this. And so he got, you know, upset enough that my dad didn't really... He didn't take a stand on many things, you know, like publicly anyway, or he wasn't confrontational, except at home. You know, that was a different story.
Where he could win. Yeah.
Right.
Where the competition really isn't all that stiff.
Right. Yeah. So he went marching into the school and told her, "What do you think you're doing?" I had epilepsy as a kid. I had my first seizure when I was 5 days old. And so he said, "What do you think you're doing shaking an epileptic child? You know, what do you think you're doing?"
Oh my God. You know, I'm kind of really feeling sorry for the teacher right now. She's like, "Oh, what did I do?"
Yeah. So she looked at him and she said, "Well, you know, she was taking her time. She wasn't going fast enough. I couldn't get her to go any faster. So I couldn't think of anything else to do. So I shook her." And he was like, "Oh yeah, that's Emily. I understand." And he, that was it. He just walked out. That was the end of it.
Wow. Huh.
He could have
just changed it all right there. He could have just stood up and been like, hey, world, this is what Emily does. You adjust to Emily, not
Emily
adjust
to you. No, he didn't. He just said, oh, I understand. And he left. Right. And he left. And that was the end of it. Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah. So it's no secret that I do. I follow my own drummer, I guess you would say. Yeah.
All right. So the world knows this about Emily, and now you're no longer working for an institution.
Right.
So is that when you started doing your own website stuff, or what'd you do next?
Yeah. So I was working as an editor, and I was asked to do a pilot program with a company I was with to see if non-attorneys could write content for attorney websites. So we had this team of people. We'd be on conference calls with people all over the country, with attorneys all over the country, and create their websites. And so it was a 6-month program, and I had a chance to work from home because I couldn't go into the office and have people coming up to my desk asking for help with editorial stuff, because my job during that pilot program was maybe 5% editorial, but 95% working on the websites. And so that's all I really had time to do. And so the only way I could really get my work done was to not be at work. So I asked if I could work from home, and they allowed that. So I started working from home, and I rather liked that.
Yeah. It has a, everybody's like, oh, it's isolating. I'm like, I know. You're saying like it's a negative.
Yeah. I can have naps. I can take naps. You know,
take naps. If I want to go to find people, I can go to a coffee shop. They're there. Okay. But they're not here. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I always said if I ever had an office, like a company that I owned with an office, I would have a nap room available for anyone that wants to take a nap. Because we're young and we're in school, and up till about kindergarten, it's a part of the day.
Right.
And then
why does it suddenly stop?
The next year, no naps. And I don't understand that. I think we all need a nap. I took a nap right before the show. I went out in the hammock, and I had a 10 or 12 minute nap in the hammock, because that's all the time I had. And it helps. Yeah.
So did I.
Right. Nap. Yeah. So I had my little nap, and I had.
Before we go off, do you want to hear the funniest nap story I have?
I would love to hear your nap story.
So my daughter was in daycare in California, in this cool little daycare. But, you know, the kids all took naps, and they were little, like 3 or 4. And there was this one kid who was some kind of hyper precocious oddball. Like, she came up and stood next to me once when I was waiting to pick up my daughter. And she grabbed my hand, and she's like, you know, 1.5 feet tall. And she's like, yeah, my mom just shows up whenever she wants to pick me up. I'm like, okay, serial killer to be. But she would... when all the other kids would fall asleep, she would wait, and then she would crawl over and bite one in the face.
Oh my. What?
Yeah, right.
Creepy.
The nap serial killer.
Yeah. Well, if I had had that experience, I might not be a napper right now, but luckily I didn't have any of those napping traumas as a child.
All right. So you're napped, you're ready to go, and now you're working. Here we go. Yeah. What was next? Right.
Yeah, so I was doing that at work from home, and then I had some stuff happen. My aunt was really sick, and she was, 400 miles away. So I wanted to be able to go visit her when I wanted to go visit her before she was no longer around to visit. So I asked to be reduced to 30 hours from 40 hours. So they allowed me to reduce my time, and I reduced to 30 hours. And so I was working 3 10-hour days. So I had a 4-day weekend. So that was a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
That was pretty good. And I was still, making most of my, 75% of my income, and working 3 days a week. So that was a really good thing. And then I started just seeing what it was like if I could get people to do websites for, because I figured that was the quickest business I could spin up. I had a little bit of experience in it, and I thought maybe this is something I can charge for. So I did what they talk about, like pounding the pavement, knocking on doors. I actually did that. I actually
just door to door in your neighborhood. Hey, you need a website?
Not my neighborhood, but I went to Main Street in Rochester, New York, and I started knocking on doors and walking in and saying, "Hey, do you need a website?" And I started getting customers. And so
hey,
I did that.
Can you hold just a second?
Yeah.
Fridge. All right. Yeah, we're back. I had to take a quick break to pay my refrigerator repairman.
It's good you paid him. That's nice.
Yeah, you know, he took like a week to do all this stuff. And my son is like, I'm going to die from not having the food that I want at all times. I'm like, culture has changed. So, okay. Where were we? What were we talking about?
All right. So we were talking about the 30 hours a week.
Yeah, you're reducing down and
doors.
You're right. Pounding the pavement.
Right. Pounding the pavement. Yeah. Knocking on
standing
doors.
With a bullhorn in the middle of the street. Who needs a website? I like it.
So one of the customers that I picked up that way was, he was a store, like he had a little store and a restaurant inside the store and just did a bunch of different things. He's right now, he's an Ethiopian restaurant. He keeps changing a little bit from, you know, what he's serving and what he does.
He's also a multi-potentialite.
He is. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. He was doing, I think then he was working at a hotel. Like he was doing all kinds of things, trying to get something going. And so I was doing his website and he didn't have a lot of money to start with. And I didn't have a lot of customers. So I was willing to do things a little cheaper and he was willing to barter. So I got a lot of chocolate, I think. And I forget the different things. I bought CDs. He had CDs that I wanted and books and I would go over there and work on the website. And so I spent a lot of time there just bringing my computer over, working on the website in the cafe. And it was, became a friendship. And
yeah, that kind of sounds fun. That sounds like a good job.
It was a lot of fun. I made tons of connections with people in the alternative health space, you know, like people that were just a lot of fun to learn from because I have a lot of training in alternative medicine. So they were my kind of people to hang out with. So I would just hang out. We became friends. So that was, you know, and a lot of my customers become friends because we spend a lot of time talking about what's going on and help each other out. So he was one of my very first customers. And so I decided that I was going to start a company. And so I went on my lunch hour from my job to downtown Rochester to the city hall. And I filed my doing business as my DBA and got that. I've since, you know, I'm an LLC at this point, but that was my first step into owning a business. I put a name on it. And I, shortly after that, within 2 months of that, I quit my full-time job or my 30-hour a week job and just focused exclusively on website design. That was it.
Was it always named WizBang?
It always was. Yeah, it was WizBang Web Solutions. Yep.
Have you watched Peaky Blinders?
No, I haven't. It's in my watch list, but I haven't seen it.
There's a character on there named Danny WizBang.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, I got that name. I went through a lot of different names and thinking about things and my nephews helped me and we all brainstormed and we were thinking about stuff. And then one day I just sat down with my big college dictionary, my giant dictionary. And I went from the back and I started flipping through to see if anything caught my eye. And by W, I found WizBang and that was it. I liked it. It means someone who is, I'm not going to be able to remember it exactly, but conspicuously effective. Something like that. So okay. It was, yeah, I forget the exact definition, but it was like, I want to be that. And so it's also from World War II, it was a bomb that would go whiz past you and you wouldn't hear it. And then it would bang when it landed. And so it was like a surprise and you wouldn't know it was coming. That's whiz bang. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably what the character came from. Cause that whole thing is about World War I, you know, and they were all in the trenches together and got traumatized.
Maybe World War I. We could have gotten that wrong. It could be World War I rather than two. Yeah.
Whatever. It's one of those big wars. Okay. So now you're doing websites for people. And what was your first branch off into your own thing?
Yeah. So I did that. And then I started, so I did that in 2005. around 2013, I think, I started taking courses in different things. So even before that, I did Reiki. I did a course in a Reiki. So I got
my- I'm in Austin. I think like there's a big hand over Austin at all times doing Reiki. Like I've run into every single, like I've been divorced for a while. So I've dated like, and you run into like, oh, what are you? Okay. Astrology, Reiki, plus you talk to right. dogs. I don't know what you do, but that's great. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. So I did Reiki level one, right around 2005 or six. I did Reiki level one for the first time. And then, so I did that and I became an ordained minister around that time. I've done a few weddings and one funeral. I did.
Now, is that because you were doing ministry stuff or you just got like the online cert? Cause I did that one day. I was like, you know, I'm going to be a minister. So I'm a minister too.
It wasn't well, good. Yeah, that's good. We're ministers together. It was, so for me, it was not an online thing. It was an in-person one day. It was a one day. It was a,
were there robes involved? Were there robes of any type? And
there wasn't, but there was anointing oil. I remember that there was an anointing oil and there may have been a stick that I held onto during the, I can't remember exactly, but the guy that did the ordination has been all over the world and done ordinations all over the world. So he got this calling to call the priests. That's what he was told in meditation or in prayer. So he started doing that and started ordaining people. He was actually, a priest or a minister. I can't remember what his background is exactly, but he had that background. And then he broke from that and started doing these ordinations. And in 2005 or six or so, when I got that, when I was had my ordination, he had already done 24,000 of them around the world. And he's done more than that by now. Like, I don't know what his number would be up to by now.
My question about like a calling, like, you know, through meditation or whatever, you get this calling, you get a lot of those and you just ignore most of them. How do you know that's the right one? Like it's.
Right. I guess you just, you know, try it out. See if it's
like,
the
right I one. Am supposed to try candy corn every day for the next 7 years. Nah, I'll ignore that one. That doesn't sound that great.
Right, that one doesn't sound so good. I think when you get a calling like that, if you have something that's truly your calling, you may get that first of all, like in something like that, but then it's going to keep coming up. If it's truly your calling, it's not something you can run away from.
I think that sounds, I mean, okay. So I was raised Catholic, which means I'm not religious at all. And you know, you see people like pushing grocery cart. Like, is that your, like, they do it. Like, it's what they're doing. It's like, did you get a calling to say, hey, Target, go to Target.
Get that cart. I'm not sure if everyone, like you said, not everyone, maybe everyone has a calling, but I'm not sure everyone hears it or pays attention to it or acts on it. So there's a lot of
different. Clearly ignored mine. So.
well, that's why they say you've clearly missed your calling. When someone says you've missed your calling, that's what it is. When they're
well,
maybe
that's because you're doing something well, and they're like, you should do that more, and you're like, yeah, I don't really like it that much.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So
okay. You got a calling about something. What was it?
Right. So he had a call to call the priest. So I felt as if I had some. I don't want to use the word calling now.
No, go ahead. Just ignore me. It's just part of the comedy, you know, mix of comedy intellectualism that I do. Just ignore the comedy.
Yeah. All right. So the calling, like I felt like I was called to do some form of ministry from when I was a kid. And I didn't know what that was exactly.
Drive teachers crazy by doing things really slowly.
Yeah.
Is that your calling?
I'm really good at that. I was really good at that. Maybe that was it. Well, I fulfilled that. So it's okay.
Okay. You got that one. Next mountain to climb.
Yeah. Right. So with feeling that, and then I grew up Lutheran. And so
that's
stuff,
Martin Luther, right?
Martin Luther.
That's not
right.
Lex Luther.
Not Lex. Definitely.
More than one Luther is my thing. Like when you say Luther, it's not really specific.
Well, I'm pretty sure the Lutheran church was around before Superman the Superman series. So
they time travel a lot in that series. So
that's true. You never know.
Okay. Right. So you're Lutheran. Gotcha.
I grew up Lutheran. So there were things that I just couldn't identify with. And I thought, if you're going to be a minister or something, it has to be something that you can 100% without questions say, I believe in this. Because if you're showing someone else, you know, this is what I believe in and you should believe in it too, then you better really believe in it. And there, I couldn't say that about every single thing that I learned in what I learned in church. So I just put that aside and didn't think much about it. When I saw this opportunity, and the only creed I would say of that church, if we want to call it a church, is keep it simple, keep it sacred. And I thought, I can handle that. So
keep it simple and keep it sacred.
Yeah.
Sounds simple. That sounds like a simple simplicity.
Right.
But I think it's probably that whole sacred concept gets kind of problematic fairly quickly.
Okay. I've noticed. Okay.
Because everybody has different sacrednesses. Right.
Well, I think that's the point, is that you can take on the meaning for yourself of what that means. So I didn't have to look at what someone else was doing and say, I have to do it that way. I could just choose that for myself. And so a lot of the people that get this ordination just do things in their regular life. They don't ever have a church or do anything beyond that. Or they might do, you know, the wedding thing. I've done, you know, a few weddings. So there's like that, you could do that, or you could do whatever you want to with it. And for me, it was just, I don't really tell many people. Well, now more people might know about it because they're listening to this.
You're gonna get a flood of people going, marry me, ordain me.
Yeah. Right. Bless I haven't told many people about that. It's not like something that comes up in everyday conversation, or I don't put it on my resume. You won't find that piece of information on LinkedIn. It's just something that I have that I've done. And so it's been nice. I've been able to do a couple of weddings for friends. It meant a lot for them, for me to do that. So that's been nice.
I can't think of a single person. You know, when I was in Catholic school, fifth grade, the priest identified me as somebody, a kid who might become a priest. And they wanted me to go to Niagara Falls to the seminary up there for a weekend with them. Thank God I didn't go. But that's the only time I've ever really been identified as seems like a future religious icon.
All right.
Other than that, people don't really believe that I have a lot of minister in me, but I think maybe I do. It's just not tapped yet.
I really think that comedians are ministers undercover.
Are they?
Yeah, I think possibly.
I think they're more hecklers in the back of the church. Like,
well, maybe, but they have a message generally and deliver it through humor, which people can accept more than sometimes a minister standing up there. So you can give a good message. And a lot of comedians do use their humor as delivering something more serious.
Do they? Like who?
You can't ask me to name people.
Who have you got that you've learned? Tell me a comedian you've learned something important from.
I'll tell you one. George Carlin. That's the only one I can think of.
Yeah. Carlin was a good grouse, man. He would just grouse about, he was good anti-politics. So
He had something. It wasn't about being funny. He wanted social change. And that's what he talked about.
Still about being funny. Like, I don't know, his last maybe three specials when he was old and crotchety. Yeah, I was like, dude, you're just now bitching. Like, this isn't
comedy anymore. That's what I thought. I saw him in person in the 90s, and I was like, why is he saying all this stuff? This is not funny.
Yeah, he was great. He was a force of nature. Okay, I got you. So you're an ordained human.
Right, yeah. So I did that. I sold Mary Kay Cosmetics for a little while.
Isn't that... I had a client for a while who was a Mary Kay regional rep, and she wanted to expand her business. And I tried to help her work with that, but I really had a hard time working within the Mary Kay mythology, the pinkness and the,
there's a lot of pink,
come on America, all that kind of stuff.
I only did it for a few months, and I had a big inventory in the end, which I ended up giving away to people. Because what are you going to do with five purple eyeshadows? I don't know. I didn't. I couldn't do too much with it. So I just kind of put that aside after a while. But what I did was I became involved with it. So I did learn a lot about sales and how to deal with rejection, because when you're a Mary Kay sales rep, you
deal with 99% rejection. Yeah.
It's a lot of rejection. So I got to get some training in that, and I would go to the weekly sales meetings most of the time and felt like what that was like as a sales team. And I actually went to Dallas for the big
good event. For you. Isn't that an event? That is spectacle and capitalism and feminism and all that stuff jammed together.
Right. So that was interesting. So I got to get that sales perspective of that and realize I never wanted to really be a salesperson. So that was good.
I that rah-rah salesperson stuff. That is a weird holdover again from earlier capitalism, when you had to sort of get everybody into the Dale Carnegie spirit. You know, most salespeople now are just cynical, you know, bastards who are like, they just have to say things over and over again.
Right. And it is, I mean, those types of sales conferences, I'm trying to think if I ever went to another one, but that was like the main one. I've been to a lot of conferences where there's that sort of energy.
Yeah. Mass hype.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a type of mass hypnotism. That's why I like the Tony Robbins things and the forum and all that. You go and you get like this charge, this emotional charge and this belief, and then it fades like 3 days later because you're outside of that community.
Yeah, but right there when you're in it, it sure is nice. It really
emotional buoying, and it's great.
Yeah, it's good. I think it's actually, I've always enjoyed things that where you have that like protection from the world, where you can have a belief and share it with other people.
Those are called cults.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Maybe I'm a cult follower, but doing those things. And then also like as a kid, like doing retreats or just going on a retreat on my own and having that time away, I think there's a lot of value in taking that time away to not have all of the stuff that comes in from outside, to just think about stuff and think a little bit and dream a little bit and get ideas flowing. So that's the benefit I get from going to conferences and things like that, is the new ideas that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't stepped in that bubble for a few days.
Yeah, I think those orbs, you know, those constructed orbs of again, intellectualism or, you know, introspection or spirituality or whatever gets dumped into the orb, whatever is in the goldfish bowl with you while you're in there. It's an intense, it's an intense psychological experience for people, and people draw from it. But I do see people jump from one to one to one to one to one to one to, you know, to try to get that high again.
So. Absolutely. Yeah. I have seen a lot of that. Yeah. There's people that just go to conferences. I try to do, well, since, you know, COVID, I've actually done a couple of online ones that were pretty good, but the in-person ones are what I prefer, because you get to actually meet people and have real conversations.
Yeah. There's more energy in that for sure.
A lot more energy, but I try to do one of those a year at least, just to have that plugging in to people that are like-minded, that are trying to do something good in the world. That's all. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I can get behind that. All right.
Yeah.
You win that moral point.
All right.
All right. Good job.
Yeah.
So that all starts to now focus itself into specific worlds, like the weight loss thing, right?
Right. Yeah. So all through all of that, I was going through fluctuations in my weight, let's say. So, so I wasn't an overweight kid. I wasn't like, I had a little bit of a belly. I remember I could, you know, like if I pushed my belly out, it popped the top snap on my pants. I called them my poppet pants. You know, I could do that because I had enough of a belly that I could do that when I was about 10 years old, but I wasn't overweight. I was never overweight as a kid. And when I got to be about 17, so about the time I got my driver's license and I no longer had to walk everywhere or ride a bicycle, I started putting on some pounds. So I started gaining some weight. And by my senior year of high school, I was starting to have to shop. Like if I went to the store, I was the highest size that they had in the regular person's store. And if I went into the bigger person store, I was the smallest size, which made me feel good because I was never the smallest size of anything. I was this tall. I'm 5'6¾ tall. And I was this height since I was 10. So I was
exactly the same height.
Are you the same height? 5'6¾.
Exactly the same.
Get out of town.
My kids give me grief because I always put 5'7" or 5'8" because I used to be 5'8", but now like they measured me and it was 5'6¾. And they're like, you're the exact same height as CeeLo.
CeeLo. I don't know who CeeLo is.
Yeah, you do. The black singer. He sings, he sang Crazy and he was in Gnarls Barkley. He was on The Voice, but he looks short. I mean, he's very stocky, but he's a short little dude.
Yeah.
I was like that. I can't be that height.
You can't be the same as CeeLo, man. Like I guess I am too. Yeah.
CeeLo level. Sounds like below CeeLo level. All right. So, okay. So you're gaining weight.
Yeah. So I gain weight. And so, then I went to college where there was unlimited food available.
That'll do it.
Everywhere food. And then, you know, my coping mechanism for being in a new place was to eat. I actually wrote a paper on the freshman 15, my freshman year, you know, the 15 pounds people gain their freshman year. Only I gained 30 pounds my freshman year.
You're an overachiever. You've always been an overachiever.
Right. Yeah, one could say that. Yeah.
I'm not obese. I am just a food overachiever.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I did that. And so I gained 30 pounds my freshman year. And then I don't know. I did do some things like I think it was my freshman year. I remember being up in the middle of the night watching television and there was a Richard Simmons Cruise to Lose commercial. And so I called the 1-800 number and I ordered my tapes and my stretchy bands and I was going to lose weight. Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to put those stretchy bands over your mouth. That's how they're actually supposed to. It's like you
tie keep you
it.
From putting food in. Yeah. Yeah. Keep the food out.
Yep.
Is that what you're supposed to do? All right. Yep.
Like if you watch the second video, that's what he told you to do. Everybody just watched the first one where he was dancing. But the second one, he tied you up.
All right. Yeah. I didn't get to that video somehow. So I got through, so I ordered that. I joined the gym, but I got shin splints. So I gave up on that.
Right?
I tried things. Yeah. I was like,
every time you try something, it reverberates in some kind of suffering.
Yes. Because I've had a lot of injuries that have happened as a result of me doing very little physical activity. So, the shin splints, I did learn something though. So if you ever get shin splints, this is what you do. You take your toes, you take your foot and you point your toes and you do the alphabet. And then a few times after that, a couple of days later, you feel pretty good. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. I got a buddy here who's a radical chiropractor and he doesn't adjust anybody anymore. He just has these intense stretches he puts everybody through. And he's like, it's always ligament problems. So your ligaments are too tight. Always.
Right.
So that's essentially what shin splints are.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ligaments are getting pulled away because you're stretching them too much while you exercise after you haven't exercised and kept them nice and loose.
Right. Well, that hurt a lot. So
they hurt for sure.
Yeah. There's a reason that in soccer you wear shin guards because that hurts. Any kind of injury to the shin is some serious pain.
I've noticed that injury just almost anywhere is like serious pain.
That's
like a hangnail, right? Like the amount of pain you get from a hangnail
right.
is completely unjustified.
It's not proportionate to what it is. Really.
Like, hey, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, that's a problem, but I don't need to suffer that much.
Right.
Like, your body is just way out of tune for what it tells you. It's like, relax. Right.
Yeah. 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 So I did start to notice that I was gaining weight and wanted to do something about it. And then I went to the nutritionist at the school. So it was basically the nutritionist slash dietitian. She made up the menus for the dining halls, which was the reason I had gained 30 pounds my first year.
Yeah, those people are compromised by the system.
Yeah. So I went in and it was at the dining hall. The consult was at the dining hall. So I went into the dining hall and there was a room I didn't know existed. And I went into this room and she put me in a chair and she wheeled in the VHS cart and put on a tape and hit play and left the room. Oh, and in that video, I learned a couple of things. One thing I learned was all I have to eat is one donut a day and I'll lose weight. Like just limit it to just have one donut. Not the whole dozen, but just one donut.
One donut.
And then I learned about serving sizes. So, like a protein serving size is the palm of your hand and, butter is like the tip of your finger. Like I learned all those things, but I also learned that when you ask for help with weight, you don't get it, that there is no help. Right. That's a good lesson right there.
That's the big lesson. Yeah.
That was the big lesson. That was the one where I finally went and asked for help and there was no help. There was just no help because you can't tell me to just eat one donut. I wasn't even eating donuts. That wasn't my problem, right? Like donuts were not my problem, but they were like, just eat one donut a day. So I couldn't relate to it. It wasn't helpful. It was stuff I already knew, but knowledge wasn't what I needed. I needed some guidance and support. So I
think about the, back then, especially this was like the era of Weight Watchers. My mom went to Weight Watchers and I saw all these things growing up. My mom was always fighting weight. And so at least Weight Watchers had absconded with some basic group psychology stuff.
Yeah, right.
So they knew like to put pressure on people in public groups would keep their behavior a little bit under control. So at least offered you a little bit of psych technique.
Yeah.
Versus just don't eat that donut,
Yeah. It's like, okay, thanks.
Thank you. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So there's very little help back then for any of that stuff.
No, there wasn't. There really wasn't. Yeah, I remember there was another Richard Simmons thing that my neighbor had it was like a little house, I think. And there was these little things and you closed, like every time you ate a certain food group, you closed the door on that little house. It was, I don't know how much that helped her either, but I just learned that there was not like nobody could really help me. They weren't that person in particular did not understand what I needed. So, and I didn't know where else to go except a nutritionist. And if they weren't going to help me, then who could help me? And so I just decided to be overweight. Why deal with it at all?
Make your peace with it. Make your peace with that pie.
Right. So I just
me and you, pie. We're just I'm committing.
Right. Yeah. I did that for a while. So I just let myself eat whatever I wanted to and didn't think about it. And the pounds kept coming on. And so by my senior year, I don't think I've ever told this part of it publicly, Dan. So the first time ever on your podcast, I'm going to tell you that I was in the shower in college and shaving my armpits. And when I did this little thing to look at what I was doing and I looked, that thing, I saw double. Just for a couple of seconds, my eyes would go funny and I would see double. And I thought that was kind of weird. But it didn't happen very often. It wasn't every time I shaved, but it was a few times. And that was really weird. So when I was home on break, I took my mom to her eye doctor and she said, my daughter's had this weird thing when she shaves that her eyes go double. So he said, bring her in. I want to talk to her. So he had me come in. He looked at my eyes and he said, I want you to go see a specialist. So he sent me to a specialist, to a neuro-ophthalmologist. And so I went to see this neuro ophthalmologist and he thought I had a brain tumor that was going to die. And I was like, all I did was see double for a couple of seconds.
Look, I'll have hairy armpits. Leave me alone. I don't want to die.
So he immediately ordered an MRI to have my brain checked. And it was like 6 o'clock on a Saturday evening. He went, doctors don't go to the MRI. He showed up at the MRI place and was there, because that's how concerned he was about what was going on in my head. So he did that. And then he ordered all these other tests. I had field of vision tests and every test you can imagine for eyes and checking what was wrong with me. And in the end, his diagnosis was, are you ready? Sometimes chubby girls have trouble with their vision, lose weight.
Wait a minute. out of all this, all the height of medical technology, that's the diagnosis that emerged.
That was a diagnosis. And he said, the only test I haven't done is a spinal tap, and we could do that, but you'll be lying flat on your back for 4 days. You'll have a headache. You'll miss some school. And it was the end of my spring break. And I said, I don't have time. Like, I got to go back to school. I don't want a headache for 4 days. I don't want a needle in my spine.
And it's just there that I'm chubby again.
Right. Yeah. He may have told me that and then told me I was chubby.
Then he's like, hey, guess what? Still chubby. Yeah. Right. Thanks for the spinal tap though.
Yeah. Right. So I didn't need confirmation that I was chubby. I knew that already. So he said, lose weight. So I went back to school and I read a book called Food by Susan Powder. And she told me to
she's a thing.
She's fierce. Yeah. She's something. Yeah. So I read her book and she said I could eat anything I wanted to, as long as everything was 20% fat or less. So I did that. And so I ate anything I wanted. I could eat an entire box of Snackwell cookies and it was okay because they were less than 20% fat. God,
no.
I did lose weight and my double vision thing disappeared and I was okay. So something worked.
It was better. Something was better. Yeah.
I was better. And I remember I had an exercise bike in my closet at my apartment. I had an apartment the second semester of my senior year, I moved off campus for the last semester of school. And so I had this bicycle in my closet and I would go in the closet and I would exercise.
In your closet?
In my closet. Yeah.
You were a closet exerciser? Literally.
Don't tell anybody. Okay. Don't tell anybody. Yeah. So I was a closet exerciser. And then I did like these chair exercises that were in her book and I did all these. And so I started feeling a little bit stronger. I felt pretty good. So I had lost by the end of my senior year. I was still FAT, but I was also like feeling a little bit better. Like I was on the right path. And then after graduating college, I one day decided to look at what I was eating. Someone said, why don't you write down everything you ate today? And I wrote it down and I was disgusted with myself. Like I couldn't believe what I ate. There was not a single nutritional thing in there. I think it was around Easter. So there's a lot of candy.
The bunnies and everything. Yeah, you wrote down
everything.
The peeps.
I wrote it all down and I couldn't believe what I ate.
17 peeps, what I had today. 17 peeps.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's like one thing I don't think I've ever binged on is peeps. I can pretty confidently say I've never binged on peeps.
What about the chocolate peanut butter Reese's eggs at Easter?
Those are good, but my weakness are the Cadbury mini eggs, I have to say. That's it, that one.
The ones with cream or there's a little chocolate
one? I like the cream eggs too. I could eat, but I'm limited to being able to eat one or two of those in a sitting, but the mini eggs, I could eat forever until the bag is gone, but then my stomach starts to hurt. So there's a little bit of a natural stop
built in. Yeah. I'm going to throw up. Ergo, yeah, maybe I'll stop until I finish throwing up.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how long I can ignore that signal from my body that this tastes good. So shut up. I'm just going to keep eating this, you know?
Food is fascinating. Like all this stuff, like I told you I have the same kind of journey, different, but the same. And at one point my change moment was realizing, oh, I'm ignorant. Like I know nothing about the body or food. And right. I'm like, I should have recognized ignorance earlier. I'm from Kentucky. Like it should have jumped up and gone, oh yeah, you don't know anything about this. And yet you are in charge. That is a just bad idea. I should not be in charge of my own eating.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of us aren't in charge of our own eating. Right.
But we are. We just have the wrong driver back here. Pleasure. And like you said, emotion and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Wrong person's in the seat.
Yeah.
We are still, unfortunately, able to choose what to jam into our faces.
We are. But I think there's moments where it's not a choice. It's an action. And you're not like for me anyway.
It's not cognitive.
Yeah. I'm not even thinking about it. And the thing is in my mouth and I go, how did this happen? And a lot of times I don't even think about it until right after I'm done eating and it's like the light switch got turned on and I say, how did I eat that? It wasn't even a choice. It wasn't even like, I don't care. I'm going to eat this anyway. It's just, it's eaten. And then I go, how did that happen?
Yeah. It's fascinating, right?
The way your
pleasure brain or your habituated brain can go around your conscious brain. It literally just shuts it down. Like, quit thinking.
Yeah.
I don't want any thinking between me and what's in front of you. Right. So we're going to blank that out for a while.
Yeah.
Then you can come back online and hate me for what, for what I just made you do.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes it's right after and sometimes it's the next day, but it's no different than drinking or,
we eat that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. What were you thinking? I wasn't thinking. That was a problem. So, So I did that. So I went and I lost some weight and then I did the disgusting Easter candy list. And then I decided that sugar was my problem. So I cut out sugar.
That was a big movement, right? That's still around, but it was a big movement maybe 90s.
This was in the 90s. Yeah. This was mid 90s. Yeah. 96, 97. So I bought a book called Protein Power. Someone had told me about that book. So I did that book.
Eads? Is that Michael Eads?
I don't remember the author.
Yeah, the protein movement. Yeah, I've tracked all this stuff too. Like I get OCD when I want to turn something into comedy.
Yeah. And
so I've read all these books. I've gone down all these pathways and been like, okay, what can I drag out of this for comedy?
Plenty. There's plenty.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. So protein powder.
Protein power. So there was power. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Mary and Michael E. That guy's actually really smart.
Yeah. Well, everything I read made sense. So I did that.
Yeah. He's a smart guy. I've met him here at Paleo FX, I think. Was it Eats? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So there was, so with that diet, I could eat as much fat as I wanted. But I had to limit my carbs. So I could have like 20 grams of carbs or something a day. So I would eat all the pork rinds I wanted to, put cheese on my eggs and eat bacon. I could do like, that was what I was eating. And then at night, I would get one little tiny miniature Reese's peanut butter egg. And I would go on the steps. I was living at my parents' house. It was the summer after college.
Would you nibble all around it like a...
I'd savor that thing like that.
Like a Lilliputian or whatever they were. You just like,
I don't know how long it took me to eat it, but I want to say I stretched it out to maybe 5 minutes for this little thing. And I would just sit there and enjoy that thing. And it was like on the steps in the dark, nobody around. It was just me and that Reese's peanut butter cup. And I didn't want anybody else to disturb me. And so I would just have that savor that thing. And then sometimes I would have, the goal of a paleo diet, I'm not sure, but I don't know. I could be misspeaking here, but this,
I'll correct you, even though I don't really know, but I'll still correct you.
All right, good. Thank you. So it's to go into ketosis. Am I right?
It's to stay into ketosis. Like if you are on a low carb paleo diet, some people do just fine with carbs. And so you can do a high carb paleo diet or a low carb paleo diet.
Okay.
Or a no carb paleo diet. It's dial aroundable.
Okay. So I was doing 20 grams. That was I think it was 20.
That's very low carb.
Yeah. It was really, really low carb. So I knew I was in ketosis because number one, my breath was disgusting smelling. Like you have this horrible breath when nobody tells you this when you're
some people definitely,
this horrible breath. And then the other thing was that I was a little lightheaded. Like I felt like I might pass out just any given minute. That was the other thing. Like I felt, but I, alongside,
you had electrolyte issues. That's what that is.
Is that what that is?
You didn't compensate the electrolytes that you weren't eating.
Well, I was drinking water. I don't know. Maybe I needed
water actually dilutes your electrolytes.
Interesting. Yeah. See, I knew there was a reason I was talking to you today so I could learn about electrolytes. Yeah. Did you know that electrolytes, so there's more potassium in a squeeze of lemon than there is in a banana. So when you have, you can take water and like instead of Gatorade, if you don't want to have the sugar of Gatorade, you take a squeeze of lemon and a pinch of salt and you put that in water, and that's your sugar-free Gatorade right there. So if you're not feeling good, make your own Gatorade. Yeah.
Yeah. No, bananas get they have a good mark. They have a good agent. They have good marketing. That's one of the ways. So I study a lot of weight loss stuff from a rhetorical perspective. Like, how do they create messaging that keeps people eating? And bananas are an interesting one, because bananas are completely sugar. I mean, that's all they are. Yeah. You know, they're starch that will turn to sugar if you just let them sit around long enough. Right. They literally turn to syrup in front of you. But because they've got potassium, that's what everybody uses to justify eating bananas.
Right.
And bananas aren't even bananas anymore. Like, they've been hybridized and cultivated so much now. Yeah, have you ever seen a banana, a wild banana, like a original banana?
I've not seen a banana in the wild. I can't
say that. You should see a banana in the wild, like not farmed, like just growing out in the wild. They're about, I don't know, 3 inches long and almost all seeds. Like, the entire thing is just black seeds, like a watermelon all the way through.
Oh, wow.
And it's packed with a little bit of banana around it. So the seeds, you know, so that an animal will eat it. That is nothing. To call that a banana and this a banana is insane.
They've completely modified bananas to make them easily digestible and like appealing. Well,
they've done it with everything. Like, cows don't look like that in the wild. When do you see a fat cow out on the plains of Africa? They're just muscle and hoof.
Right.
But I'll tell you what, we've gone over an hour. Why don't we make this part one and part two? We'll come back we'll pick up on food stuff, because I love talking about this stuff.
Sounds good. Yeah, I can talk about food stuff forever. So that's a good plan.
All right. Well, we'll call this at part two. And then next time I'll have somebody working on my washing machine or something, so it has continuity to it.
Yeah, we need to keep it consistent.
And you have a new balloon next time.
Okay. I will definitely. I'll fill this one up so he's happy again.
I want a different balloon. We can't go back to the same balloon. It's got to have some variety.
I'll get you a new balloon. All right.
Put some producer spice on this. Like, a frowny balloon.
You're giving me a challenge. I accept.
Oh, awesome. Well, thanks for jumping on. Super fun. Where can people go to check out your website to hire you to do spectacular work?
Whizbangweb.com. That's whizbang with an H. So whizbangweb.com.
That would be. You want to keep that H in there.
You do, because I can't guarantee what you're going to find if you don't have that H.
Very different product.
I don't want to send anybody to the wrong place. So.
All right. Well, check that out, everybody. Emily Carpenter at Whizbang. We will come back and we will do the second part of this and continue to talk about food. I may do like five parts, because I like talking about food and weight. And it's so fascinating. You can go to my website and look up all the way down on my YouTube channel is an hour and 5 minute, no, 73 minute show about weight loss, how I lost 125 pounds. And I used to punish people in comedy clubs with it. It's literally an hour, 13 minutes of clever fat jokes. And I would do it for fat people.
It's a good segment. It's worth time to take to watch it.
Yeah. There's lots of comedy in there. And every once in a while, I'll give you a little piece of advice. So check that out. All right. Well, we'll come back around. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Everybody say goodbye to Emily. And we'll see you next time. Get out there and persuade some people. They need it.